Amen. Numbers chapter number 21, we continue in our series, Stories Our Children Should Know. And this is a good story for our children, and apparently a story that was even familiar hundreds of years ago, a couple thousand years ago, in Jesus' time, because he referenced it in passing in conversation with Nicodemus as something that would have been readily understood. Of course, they were students to some degree of their scriptures. This would have been common then and should be common to us as well. It speaks to a common sin of children, and I'm afraid often a sin of adults too, the sin of complaining. The sin of complaining. I have to give you a personal testimony. It was just a couple days ago, and I told the kids that the Lord help me, that I was faced with a situation where I was kind of grumbling and starting to just, you know, get negative about stuff. And it's one of those places where you could start to formulate and make your case and think through the details, so the next time somebody asks you, what's wrong, you could give them the spiel and it would sound really good, you know. And I realized, in that moment, in that circumstance, you have an opportunity here. You can look at this a different way. And I wish I could say that I had responded better in times past when God's given me that. But by his grace, was able to change the attitude there. But we certainly aren't exempt, are we, from the temptation to complain. And we know, as parents and grandparents, it almost seems built in, like that kids may not survive a day if they don't complain or do something childlike like that. We should, I guess, expect them to be children and to be disciples of them. But in just a short passage here in Numbers 21, in only six verses, God chose to include and preserve a story that has some pretty dramatic parts to it. And we have to think, why did he encapsulate this? Why did he draw out this particular point? But look in Numbers 21 and verse number 4. Speaking of the children of Israel, and they journeyed from Mount Hor by the way of the Red Sea to compass the land of Edom. This is to go around the land of Edom. So as they were coming across Arabia there into the south of Israel was the nation of Edom, and they were going to go around that, and the soul of the people was much discouraged because of the way. And the people spake against God and against Moses. Wherefore have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? For there is no bread, neither is there any water, and our soul loatheth this light bread. And the Lord sent fiery serpents among the people, and they bit the people, and much people of Israel died. Therefore the people came to Moses and said, we have sinned, and we have spoken against the Lord and against thee. Pray unto the Lord that he take away the serpents from us. And Moses prayed for the people. And the Lord said unto Moses, make thee a fiery serpent, and set it upon a pole. And it shall come to pass that every one that is bitten, when he looketh upon it, shall live. And Moses made a serpent of brass, and put it upon a pole. And it came to pass that if a certain had bitten any man, when he beheld the serpent of brass, he lived. And so We see as they're coming across here, they're going to compass the land of Edom. If you look at the topography there, the geography, and you find the land of Edom, and then you see if they were going to go east, which I think they were, and not go west up along the way toward the Philistine territory, they're going to go east, it would push them or continue to direct them into the desert, into this Arabian desert. And so you imagine how arid it is and how dry and maybe at times even difficult to traverse that kind of territory. And because it says because of the way that they grew discouraged. You ever grow discouraged because of the way that you're in? It just seems like you're navigating through difficult territories that are dry and even hard to walk, and it just makes everything laborious. It says that their people was much discouraged because of the way. And maybe it was because Edom wouldn't let them through, or Edom was treating them in a hostile way. Whatever the reason, they had to compass Edom and go around and not through. And there may be times in your life when you feel like, well, it's really not my fault that I'm here. If it were my choice, I'd do something different. But because of so-and-so, or because of that decision, or because somebody else chose to do something, now I'm in this lot in life. Do you find yourself there? We all do. We all do. Whether it's a governmental decision, whether it's a family decision, whether it's a church decision, whether it's a personal decision, there's some reason, and a lot of times it may not be directly your fault, as it were, that now you're kind of struck out or stuck into the desert to travel more. And you're tired, and it's frustrating, and you're discouraged. But though others are responsible for some of our difficulties, we're responsible for our response. You notice the overlap of those two words. The fact that we have an opportunity to respond renders us responsible. We have the capacity to respond. We are not automatons. We're not robots. We have a feeling about this situation that we're in, and we tend to verbalize it and think about it. And the way that we verbalize it and think about it is on us. Though the reason that we're there may be someone else's fault. But discouragement leads to complaining. Last couple Wednesday nights, we've been talking about songs in the night, and we dealt with the night of depression and the night of doubt. Well, we could certainly add to that the night of discouragement, when your courage, that is your strength, for whatever reason is beginning to be leaked off. It's something's drawing off of it, and your energy and your strength is taken away, and your resolve and that inner resource that you have seems to have diminished, and now you're discouraged. You're without heart, and that can very easily lead to complaining. But when we get to that point, and when it got to that point in their lives, you see that it wasn't just being discouraged and now complaining, but it revealed some other things about them. And you know as well as I do that when you get discouraged and things start to look gray, your perspective of a lot of things changes. And things you might have said about, that you would say about something now isn't what you'd have said about it a week ago or a month ago. But in that distorted perspective, we begin to turn everything sour. Notice what they said in verse 5. And people spake against God and against Moses. Now think about the sin of that. And this is partly why it's valuable for our kids to know this story. For us to give them a real life example of real people who complained and what God thought of that and what punishment came because of it. When they were discouraged, they spoke against God and against the man that he had put in authority. Has God put authorities in our lives? He has, even in our lives as adults. Look, we're never going to escape authority. Your kids should know that. And the authority that he set over them is first you as a parent. And when they speak against you and in some ways speak against God himself, that's an awful thing. But notice what they said. We've heard this how many times now. Wherefore have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? And then they add this: for there is no bread. Wait a minute, no bread. Oh well, it goes on later and says, well, and our soul loatheth this light bread. That's kind of different, but it's not bread like we remember, like we had. There's no bread, and there's no water. And our soul despises this manna. Is there something wrong with us when we despise the thing that God gave to us? Now, is there a food that you could eat for the rest of your life? For me, yes. Peanut butter, okay? Short answer. And the kids asked me that one day. Could you really eat that for the rest of your life? Absolutely. you know, as a school kid, if my mom would pack peanut butter jelly every day, that would have been great. But now and then, people have to throw in bologna or pimento loaf or whatever that stuff is called. But there's certain foods that would be all right. But they were getting sick of it. And they said, we despise this light bread, and accused God of giving them essentially nothing. He's given us this, but what good is that? We don't have what we really want and supposedly what we really need. as if they hadn't seen time and again that God could give them what they needed. And so, yes, they were discouraged. And we can kind of understand to a certain point being discouraged, but then to turn that discouragement toward against God and to say, God, you're the problem. And Moses, you're the problem because we don't have what we need. And what you are giving us, it's disgusting. It's distasteful. It's less than adequate. Discontent, anger, frustration came boiling out when they were put in that hot water situation. And the Lord sent, verse 6, the Lord sent fiery serpents among the people. Well, the question is, what is a fiery serpent? It's interesting. The word fiery is the same word describing the creatures in Isaiah 6. You know what the word is? Seraphim. Seraphim. Wait, hold up. Are you saying like these angelic snakes? No, that's not what I'm saying. I think if you do a little word study, in my estimation, the word itself indicates a likeness to fire. In the case of the angels, it could be referring to the brightness or some aspect of their appearance, bright like fire. In the case of the serpents, it could be referring to their appearance or the effect of their bite, that it burned. But still, there was a likeness to fire. So these are fiery serpents, either because of the way they look or maybe because of their bite. So I started doing some study on serpents, and we know that a lot of you, I'm sure, are just snake lovers, and so you'll love to hear this. But think, when you think about serpents, you think about speed of travel, speed of attack, and speed of kill. Speed of travel, how many of you ever heard of the Sidewinder? The Sidewinder snake, fascinating snake. If you watch a video of the snake, it actually moves sideways, and it moves. It's the fastest snake on land at 18 miles per hour. Now, we've been amazed in years past as we've gone down to the Hannibal Cannibal 5K, 10K race, and they start off the race, and these guys take off, and some of these guys are just amazing and returning minutes later having run 3.1 miles. And they're running about a six-minute mile, if I remember correctly. Am I right on that? About a six-minute mile, or was it 7 minutes? Maybe it's a six-minute mile. And so you go, okay, a six-minute mile, that's basically 10 miles an hour. The Sidewinder snake almost doubles that speed. You can't outrun it, kind of thing. It's fast. That's a fast snake. Another one is unique and fast. As I was reading through these snakes and kind of enjoying what I was reading there, lo and behold, no joke, I came on one called the Chrysopelea, the flying snake. Now, some actually think the fiery serpent could speak to a flying snake, or one source says that, I think, but I don't necessarily think so. But the Chrysopelea is a flying snake because it'll get up in a tree and it will launch itself out and then change its shape in such a way that it will glide down at about 30 feet a second and go as far as 330 feet. So in some ways, it is a fast snake as it's gliding through the air. The speed of travel. Now there's speed of attack. The Gaboon viper is more of a sluggish snake, but when it's striking, its head can reach speeds of 175 to 200 miles per hour. Meaning, you didn't see it happen. Okay, once it struck, you're done. Then you have the speed of kill. That is, how potent is their venom? The king cobra, one of the snakes I read about, maybe it was the king cobra, only needs two drops of its venom to really begin working its thing in the body, okay? Although it has many more drops stored up in its fangs. Now, if you look at the habitats of these various snakes, the sidewinders in southwestern U.S. and Mexico. The Chrysopelea, the flying snake, is more Southeast Asia. The Gaboon viper is sub-Saharan Africa. The king cobra may not quite be in the territory where the people of Israel were. However, possibly a relative of the king cobra, that's called the Egyptian cobra, is found in the Arabian Peninsula. I happen to think that this wasn't it wasn't necessarily a miraculously made viper. that it wasn't just suddenly these snakes appeared out of nowhere. I think God maybe drew them out, if you will, or could have created more, but were they some strange creature that's never existed before? I personally don't think so, because in another passage, it talked about three things in the wilderness, and the first two were just kind of common, ordinary things. And so he mentions the serpent as well. And so was it that when they sinned, God in his sovereignty just pulled the snakes out of every corner, if you know what I mean? They just came out of nowhere. Some of these snakes I can't remember the word they use for it, but they essentially hide themselves up to their head in the sand. And they ambush, that's what it is, ambushing snake. But anyway, the Egyptian cobra, we're familiar with a cobra that stands up, the only snake that can stand up, kind of spreads out its fan. And the Egyptian cobra, also a very potent serpent. Was it the Egyptian cobra? I don't know. But he says that in response to their complaining, they're speaking against God and speaking against Moses again, he sent fiery serpents among the people, and they bit the people, and much people of Israel died. Now, you have to ask yourself the question, would I want the reason of my death to be complaining? I know, we'd say, well, actually, it was a snake. Hey, how'd your uncle die? Oh, well, he complained. I mean, it was a snake, but it was a snake because he had complained. You know, he was a complainer. Oh, okay. We'd rather it be natural causes, or better yet, I was trying to save someone else's life. But to say, oh, yeah, my dad died because he was a complainer. Is that really what you want to leave to the next generation? Is that the example that you want to set? Oh, yeah, he was against God and authority in general. That's not a legacy to leave, but for some of them, that's the last thing they did. They spoke against the Lord, and what he's provided is inadequate. And it was only minutes later, they were bitten by a snake, and they were dead. And so it says in verse number 7, therefore the people came to Moses. This became a problem, and it became a problem in a hurry. And they said, we have sinned, for we have spoken against the Lord and against thee. Now, who told them that? Who told them what their sin was? I don't think anybody had to tell them what it was. What does that tell you? They knew what they were doing. They did it consciously. They did it intentionally. They knew they were complaining. They knew that their discouragement had let their mouth just run and that they were talking against the Lord and against Moses. And all of a sudden, when these fiery serpents come, they figure it out. Or they know in a hurry. And they rush to Moses, but it's too late for some. And they say, we have sinned, for we have spoken against the Lord and against thee. So there are some that come and confess. They say what they've done right to Moses. And you say, well, that's good. And they say, pray unto the Lord that he may take away the serpents from us. So we think not just on complaining this morning, but on prayer. The leaders are sometimes called to pray for people who brought their conditions on themselves. You follow me? Some people come to you, oh, pastor, pray for me because we're in this situation. In your mind, you're thinking, well, I know you're in that situation. And maybe your friends, you know, or maybe somebody you see on Facebook, oh, pray for us. We're really dealing with this right now. Well, the truth might be in many cases that they got themselves into that mess. Does that mean you shouldn't pray for them? No. You can still intercede to God on their behalf. Aren't we all sinful and broken and immature and need to grow and make mistakes and shoot ourselves in the foot and get ourselves into places where now we need prayer and we need help, but yeah, it's a little embarrassing. Yeah, we've all been there. They wanted Moses to pray, and we could almost say, oh, come on, they want Moses to pray. Why don't they pray? Well, I partly understand. They were escalating this to the top as fast as possible. Moses is in charge. He's the man that's got the ear of God. We've sinned against him. We confess to him, and now we ask him as our leader, in some way, a priest, to intercede for us. They escalated it to the top, and for many, the remedy didn't get there in time. The prayer came too late. Many died. But there was a remedy. And notice that it wasn't just the prayer. Because when they came to him and they said, Moses, pray for us, and Moses did pray for them, then God responded in verse number 8. And the Lord said unto Moses, make thee a fiery serpent and set it on a pole, and it shall come to pass that everyone that is bitten, when he looketh upon it, shall live. You know, it wasn't just that pray and it'll all be over. The prayer will take care of the problem. No, the prayer was a good start. In fact, it brought the response of God to say, now, here's the solution. Here's the remedy. Now, in their case, the remedy was found in looking to a physical object bound to one location. This brass serpent on a pole. Notice also that the remedy was not offered until many had died and some came to confess their fault in the matter. God didn't grab Moses and say, hey, you need to start doing this. So when they confessed and asked him to pray, and Moses prayed, that now God gave the remedy. But I want you to notice there is a distinction in that and the crucifixion. If you turn over to John chapter 3, in John chapter 3, Jesus, now hundreds of years later, is speaking to Nicodemus, and he quickly references this story in John chapter 3 and compares it to himself and to the work that he is going to do. In John chapter 3 and verse 14, Jesus said to Nicodemus, "And as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness," that's exactly where we're reading. It's what the story we're talking about. "And as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, even so must the Son of Man be lifted up, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish, but have eternal life." I have a work to do, and I'm going to be lifted up, and those who will look to me in faith can be saved. Now, keep reading. "For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish, but have everlasting life." Now, read the next few verses in light of the brass serpent on the pole story. "For God sent not his Son into the world to condemn the world, but that the world through him might be saved. He that believeth on him is not condemned, but he that believeth not is condemned already, because he hath not believed in the name of the only begotten Son of God. And this is the condemnation, that light is come into the world, and men loved darkness rather than light, because their deeds were evil. For everyone that doeth evil hateth the light, neither cometh to the light, lest his deeds should be reproved. But he that doeth truth cometh to the light, and that his deeds may be made manifest, that they are wrought in God." There's some people that don't like the light, and it would be hard to imagine that as they're there dying of a snake bite, and he holds up the brass serpent on a pole, that some people would not want that light. That could have been the case. However, the stories are a little bit differently. Now, how does this event, the biting by the snakes and the lifting up of the brass serpent, represent Jesus and the salvation he offers? Well, it would be similar in the simplicity of the remedy. The simplicity of the remedy. Look to the serpent. Look to Jesus Christ. It's not crawl on broken glass and learn the catechism and go through all these extra. It's simply look to Christ as you look to the serpent. And then it's the fashion of the remedy. I think this is an interesting thought, that God didn't say, make you an angel and post it on a pole and hold up the angel to the people, that when they see the angel, they'd be healed. What did they hold up? He held up a replica of the thing that had caused their death. Paul said, "For he hath made him to be sin for us who knew no sin." It's that what was on the cross, this dying, bleeding, tortured form, was made spiritually sin. The thing that had been the cause of our death, he was made sin for us, that we might be made the righteousness of God in him. I see a similarity there to the fashion of the remedy. And then I see the carrying of the remedy, that as this one was lifted up on a pole, so this one was lifted up on a cross. Similar. But how does this event not adequately or accurately represent Jesus and the salvation he offers? In our story, This remedy did not come until they confessed and prayed, and God told them the remedy. Several had already died. Now they go out with the remedy, and some are delivered. Understand, this is a physical deliverance. That's one of the differences. But the timing, the initiation, it's almost like the people initiated it by their confession. I'm not slighting God, but what I'm saying is that in salvation, in spiritual salvation, Revelation 13:8 tells us that he's the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. God already had this remedy long before the first sin. That was already the design. God was already looking toward humanity and their deliverance and their reconciliation. 1 John 4:19 says, we love him because he first loved us. Romans 5:8, and God demonstrated this love toward us in that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. While we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. But that was already the plan. God had initiated that since before the world began. But back to our story in Numbers chapter 21. I want you to note the remedy. God didn't, they didn't just pray and God healed the masses. Moses just gave this great uplifting prayer and zoop, everybody started to feel better and the wounds healed up and the snakes went away. No, he didn't just heal the masses, but he made a way whereby those who would submit to his instruction and believe his word would be healed. There isn't a great prayer, and maybe as much as I wish there was, there's not a prayer that one man can pray and save the world. But God has made a way. He is not unjust. He is a perfect God, and he's made a way whereby people who will listen to him and believe his word can be saved. And it seems like those who don't wouldn't want to be. Don't want to be. They don't want the light. They don't want the remedy. They don't want the truth. They'd rather have their own way. Saying a prayer wasn't the end of the punishment. God responded with a solution to which they individually must respond. Yes, it started off with a confession of the sin to Moses and a prayer to God, and now God offers a remedy that each person individually must enact for their own betterment, their own healing. The prayer of a select few did not affect the salvation of the nation, but it was simply a look. And so the songwriter wrote, look and live, look and live. You know, the gospel isn't complicated, but it is sometimes difficult. The gospel's not complicated. You have to recognize that you're separated from God by your sin. You're broken. You're a rebel. And Jesus Christ took your place on the cross, lived a perfect life, took your place in punishment, took the wrath of God for that sin, and rose from the dead. And now, if you will confess to God that you are who you really are, and you'll trust in Jesus Christ alone, you can be a child of God. If you'll say, God, save me for Jesus' sake, that's not hard to do, except that we're proud. And to say, well, I'm a rebel. I'm pretty good. I'm a pretty good guy. No, you're not. But to say that and to believe and to say, I really want that more than I want this that's pulling me down, that can be a difficult thing to do. And so we see there was complaining, there was prayer, there's the remedy. And lastly, as we head towards a conclusion here, think about the carrying of that remedy. I saw one picture that, you know, as artists kind of reconstruct what they imagined that the scene looked like. And in this particular scene, it was a pole with a snake on it. But the unique thing about it was this pole was like surrounded by rocks. It's like they had planted it, almost like a flagpole. The problem with that? There's dying people for who knows how many yards and a quarter mile, half mile around. Not sure they can see that pole or whether they could get to it, or maybe they're in their tent. I imagine the story a little differently. I imagine someone carrying that pole, maybe running around. I don't know how you see it. Running around with that pole. Look, look on the serpent and live. God said, if you look at the serpent, you'll be healed. Look, look on the serpent. God said. And you're trying to get this to as many people in the camp as you can. Now, when you're holding the pole, you have the confidence to rush to help. But if you lack confidence in the solution, you're much more hesitant. If you really believed what you're saying, God said, look at the serpent and you'd be healed. I've seen it happen already over there. You'd have confidence. But if you're holding that pole and you're like, I don't know if I really get this. I mean, looking at a brass thing is going to like heal my snake. But I don't, how does that work? I don't know that I buy all that. You'd feel, do I really want to run around and make a fool of myself? To tell people to look on this snake to be healed? Really? How confident are we in the gospel? You think that affects how we might approach people with it? Are we rock solid confident? What you need to do is look to Jesus Christ. You're separated from God by your sin. He's waiting to save you. If you'll look to Christ and say, He is my substitute, it's not in me. I'm a rebel, but He can save me by His death and resurrection. He can save me, and God, I'm asking you to save me for Jesus' sake. If we're confident of that, that can certainly affect our attitude. You know, when we're not confident of it, we not only don't witness, but it kind of affects our own spirit, doesn't it? Have you ever been there? A lack of assurance? You're not taking very many grandiose steps in Christian maturity. You're not taking any at all, hardly, because you don't even know the very first step of whether I don't know if I'm saved. Did I say the right thing? What is this gospel thing? Did I mean it enough? Did I know enough? And we struggle with that, and it holds us back. Can you imagine as you're carrying that pole and you're running to different parts of the camp? That there's a lot of turmoil going around. There's a lot of chaos. If they were non-poisonous snakes, there would still be a lot of turmoil and a lot of chaos. And you know, you go into a tent and the guy is standing on the chair and the lady's like, get off the chair, that's my spot. And people are running, oh my goodness, there's snakes. But when you know they're biting people and people are dying and they just seem to come, like maybe they're coming out of nowhere, or you run out of your tent and there's three more and there's... They're just like, they're waiting for you. They're about to strike. Oh, no, what am I doing? And you're screaming, and people are wailing. They're crying, and some are in, bow, they've hurt. And you read about what happens when you get bit by a snake and how it happens. And and so there's just crying, and there's just yelling, and people may be running around. Come help, help. He's bit over here. What can we do? Somebody find help. And so there's just pandemonium. So as you go running into this chaotic crowd with a pole and a snake, they may not have to really be paying attention to what you're doing. And you're going to have to try to communicate over the shrieks of terror and sadness the message that has to be proclaimed. Sometimes people won't hear what you're saying until you get close enough to get their attention and speak over their pain. And in our lives, we need to get close enough to people to gain their attention and speak over the pain. Because life's chaotic. You're running around, maybe saying something and holding up something. They're not really paying attention. Because their life is in shambles too. And they've got a lot of noise going on. You think about as I looked at the cobra. Cobra strikes. He bites you. You got 30 minutes. Basically got 30 minutes. One guy was, I can't remember which story I read a bit, but one guy was brought in. I think he was bit on a finger, maybe. And anyway, he got in, I think, inside of 20 minutes and still died days later because it starts to affect the body and the nervous system and then the heart. And when the heart can no longer respond or maintain its function, then eventually you die. When people are bitten by sin, they're sometimes in various stages of death, but if eventually it gets to the core and it gets to the heart, if you will, the heart becomes hard, God's not always going to strive with man. God will give mercy for so long. God will convict by his Holy Spirit, and God will give the gospel for so long, but there is a expiration date, if you will, on everybody. And so it's true, as Jesus said in the New Testament, the fields are white unto harvest. It's ready to go, guys. It's harvest time. And we need to be conscious that we can't just be lazy. We can't just casually say, this snake here on the pole, if you know, it's kind of neat. Isn't it a neat snake? Yeah, it's kind of cool. Maybe you ought to visit sometime and we'll tell you about the snake. Maybe we need to have a little bit more aggression. I'm not saying that God intends. Take it in balance. I know sometimes we can be conscientious and say, I walked by that guy and now I feel grieved that. What opportunities is God giving you? I'm asking you though, do you have boldness? Are you willing to speak up about the faith? Are you willing to go to a friend and say, you know, we've been friends for a long time, and I'm sorry to say, I've really never asked you this question, but I feel like I could because you'd listen to me because you care about me like I care about you. But there's something that's really important to me, and I just want to ask you about it. You're important to me. And I want to know if you have a relationship with God, meaning do you know your sins are forgiven? Has there ever been a point in your life when you recognize that you were separated from God who is life and that if you stayed in that separated state, one day you'd die and go to hell? I don't want that for you. And as a friend, I would want you to know what God said about being reconciled to himself. Could I tell you about that? And there'd be various conversations at various times. And of course, there's a whole context to that. But what I'm saying is, let's not be lazy and say, oh, another time. Yeah, maybe, the gospel. I'm busy. Let's be careful to prioritize and to say, who does the Lord want me witnessing to? Who do I need to bring the pole to? And how bold should I be? God give me grace to be bold. You know, Paul prayed for boldness. No, get out. The Apostle Paul, yes. Apostle Paul wanted people to pray for him to be bold. We can pray for each other to be bold. Lord, help us to stop being satisfied with where we are. Lord, stir in us a boldness and a desire to see people and to see the need and to get close enough through the chaos to speak into the pain, the peace that only Jesus can give. So this morning, I guess I could ask you three questions. Number one, are you a complainer? Are you a complainer? If so, you need to plead guilty this morning and ask for forgiveness. Let's stop it. Just stop the chain of events right here and say, God, I've been a complainer. I've spoken against you. I've spoken against authority. It's a wrong spirit. It's a stench in your nostrils. It's a black eye to your name. And I'm sorry. Help me, God, by grace to have a right spirit. Number two, are you an interceder? Do you pray? Do you pray for other people? Number three, are you a pointer? Are you pointing people to the one that's lifted up? Are you pointing people to the remedy? Are you telling them to look and live? As the serpent was lifted up, so Jesus Christ was lifted up to die. He was made sin for us that we might be made the righteousness of God. And as much as I may wish that the prayer of a few of us could save everyone in need, the decision to humbly look at the one lifted up is a personal decision. Have you made that decision this morning? Have you made the decision to accept the remedy provided by God, to look to the crucified and risen Christ alone for your personal, eternal healing and peace with God? If you haven't, that's step number one. You're dying. And as Jesus said in John, you know, that the one that accepts Christ is saved, but the one that isn't is condemned already. The venom's in you, man. You've got a time frame. You're going to die, and if you die without Christ, you're gone forever. It's not that that he's a health insurance policy or life insurance policy. He's the anti-venom. He's the brass serpent on the pole. You're dying, and you need to be saved. And if you're not this morning, I beg you to come to take care of that. If you are, you say, Pastor, I am, then will you deal with this? Are you a complainer?